Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is you don't talk about Write Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hello, I'm Heather Worsley, and welcome to Write Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. This is my first time, and I'm really, really nervous.
Oh, bless.
Today, I'm joined by Teresa.
Hi.
Nicola.
Hello.
Linda.
Hi.
Stephanie.
Hi there.
And Pat.
Hello.
This week, we've got Steph reading her work in progress. Nicola's going to share with us the quirks of writing. We have an interview with poet Neil Fawcett, and we're going to talk about our own favourite poets and poems. We've got Teresa telling us what's on her bedside table. But first, Linda is going to ask us to name the novel.
Okay, everybody ready?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Okay. I do hope I've done the clues well enough that you at least don't get it till the third. Clue number one. This novel, published in 1997, is set in India and won the Man Booker Prize for Fiction. It received stellar reviews in America and was one of the five best books of 1997 by Time magazine, but the reception in the UK was quite different, where the awarding of the Booker Prize caused controversy. In India, the book was criticized for its description of sexuality, and the author had to answer charges of obscenity.
Oh, interesting. Whoa. Might not be what I thought it was.
No, I've changed my mind.
Well, looks good. Teresa didn't get it on the first one. Okay.
Well, I think I might have got... Is that the first
one? Well, I've written something down.
That's the first
one. I've written something down and crossed it out and written something else down. Okay. So I've got it on the first one.
You've got it.
Too.
You've got it. No, I haven't got it. I don't think.
You don't? No. Either one. Yeah. Clue number two. The story begins with the funeral of young Sophie Moore, who had drowned. Beneath the drama of a family tragedy lies a background of local politics, social taboos, and the tide of history, all of which come together in a slip of fate, after which a family is irreparably shattered.
No, I've just crossed out one before.
No, no, I think it's still, I think I've still got it. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the author.
I've stopped picking my pen up.
Yeah. I'm just doing it all in my head. All in my head.
Clue number three. The opening lines of the novel are, May, an Imenim, is, I'm sorry, I'm not pronouncing it right, Imenim, A-Y-E-M-E-N-E-M, May, in that place, is a hot, brooding month. The days are long and humid. Black crows gorge on bright mangoes and still dust-green trees.
Lovely.
I wish everyone could see her face.
I know. It's so interesting that Teresa, you don't...
No, I mean, I thought it... Go on.
Satanic Verses.
Oh, no.
No, I thought it might be Midnight's Children, but I'm not sure about the year.
Well, I started off with The Kite Runner, but then I thought The God of Small Things by Arundhati.
You got it. Arundhati Roy.
I couldn't tell you how his name's
spelled. I don't know. It's a her. It's a woman.
I wrote down
Arundhati.
I was just going off the controversy.
The God of Small Things. You're right, Steph.
Yeah, good.
Which clue?
The first one.
Why was it controversial?
The first one. It was the end of the first
sexuality.
One.
Sexuality. Oh, yeah. No, in India.
In India.
See, that's the thing.
Oh,
right.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I didn't... It was the only bit that gave it to me.
It must be having sex in India.
Well, by sexuality, does she mean, you know, heterosexuality or, you know, something like that, which
well,
is controversial?
I think what it said actually was its unrelenting description of sex.
Okay.
Anyway,
too much of it.
Okay.
Yeah. Well,
I think this is all just making my to read list too long.
I was going to say that sounded great. That book, as from your description. Yeah.
You know, I keep writing down on the edges here.
It
names
was very
of
well liked in my book club.
That,
yes.
Was it?
I'm sorry. I'm sorry you didn't get it.
No, you're not.
Oh, I got one that Teresa didn't.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I did have, you know, with the opening line, I was thinking I've read that, the black crows and the hanging on the mangoes, but I
don't know how happy that makes me.
You may have noticed, lovely listener, that our competition has shifted now. The competition has shifted not from trying to compete against each other to guess the book, but to be the person who sets the competition that nobody guesses the book.
Or just to beat me.
To beat Teresa.
Yeah, to beat Teresa. Yeah. Aww. Well, that's the way it is. You rise to the top, people try to knock you down.
Okay, thanks very much for that. And now it's over to Steph to tell us about her work in progress.
Yes, I'm going to read you a short excerpt from Hellinglei, and this is a scene set in 1924, but actually Grace is remembering it. She's received a postcard from Albert, which she shoved away in a cupboard and didn't read, and then one afternoon she comes across it in her locker. And she starts to fan herself with it because it's warm, and she realises it's a postcard from him, and she reads it again, and then she starts to reminisce about their courtship. So this is just an excerpt from their courtship. One blisteringly hot Sunday afternoon in August of 1924, Grace and Albert went to the beach, unchaperoned. Self-consciously, they donned bathing costumes and stood side by side at the water's edge, limbs bare. On Albert's upper right arm was a tattoo of a long-haired girl wearing a grass skirt. Grace resisted the urge to touch it. "This is Lulu," said Albert, following her stare. "Watch and I'll make her dance for you." As he began to flex his bicep, the little Hawaiian girl moved her hips from side to side. Albert began to sing along with the dance, his eyes fixed on Grace's face. Later, sitting on the pebbles on Brighton Beach, looking out to sea, they talked of the names they'd give to their many, as yet unborn, children. Grace wanted all the boys to be called Albert, but Albert wanted them to be George for his father, Nelson for his grandfather, or perhaps Horatio, Grace had teased. The girls would be Grace, Sarah, and Gloria after Miss Swanson. As the heat began to fade from the day and the time to say goodbye approached, Grace was filled with an unfamiliar desire. "Please make Lulu dance for me again before we go," she murmured, stroking Albert's arm. This time they sang the song together, swaying in time, eyes locked, oblivious to the world around them. "In my dreams, sweet memories I recall of days which sped too quickly past. On my ear your soft voice seems to fall as in my arms I hold you fast. Farewell to thee, my passion flower, whom I long in vain. My only hope that faithful you will be until we meet again." As their dance ended, as if perfectly choreographed and much practised, Albert lowered his mouth to hers. It wasn't their first kiss, but it was their most brazen. Now, leaning against a high brick wall in an airing court at Hellinglei Hospital, Grace licked her lips to recall the taste of Albert. She closed her eyes, willing the August sun to kiss her bare skin. She felt an almost forgotten tug of longing. "Damn you, Albert!" She willed her thoughts to reach him. "You gave me the strength to be my own person, and then you betrayed me. Now I'm the wrong version of myself, and I don't know how to find my way back." When she opened her eyes, she noticed her thumb was stroking the words, "You're Albert."
Wow.
Beautiful, really.
It is.
Some
beautiful.
Poignant. Very beautiful. Really lovely.
So sad, poor Grace.
I loved it, but I had so many questions.
Go on.
So how did they get changed? Were they in a changing machine?
Yes. Or were they it did cross my mind. That crossed my mind, actually.
It actually crossed my mind as well.
In 1924, it might have been a beach hut. It might have been under a big towel.
I think you need to say so that we don't need to wonder about it and we can concentrate.
It could have been
on
a beach hut as well, but they did have...
There were beach huts.
Yeah, we did have beach
huts. But it's the other thing, self-consciously.
Self-consciously next to each other with their bare limbs out. That was fine, but it was how did they get into their swimsuits in the first place?
If it was a beach hut, presumably they would have gone in one at a time.
They would have gone
at
a time.
Definitely.
But it was probably a public beach hut, or it would have been under a big kind of shroud.
Yeah, sometimes they have changing rooms on the beach.
Yeah.
I just think it needs mentioning because you know, if all of us were wondering about it, we're not concentrating on what's going on next.
I get that.
Yeah. And the other bit was when they were singing together. I was bothered by the fact she wouldn't have known all the words because she's only just seen the tattoo and.
Well, okay, the song is actually a song that was written in the late 1870s.
Yeah.
And bear in mind that Grace's parents were in the music hall,
yeah,
so she would have known, okay, the song. Yeah, it would have been, yeah, a very well-known song.
Okay.
The song is actually Aloha E.
I was going to say,
yeah,
I couldn't. I knew it had to be a sort of Hawaiian,
yeah,
yeah, yeah.
It's by Charles Werner. Aloha E is the most beloved of all Hawaiian songs and was composed by Princess Lili Ukalani in the late 1870s. Although it's categorised as a love song, most people consider it a song of farewell.
Mm. Yeah. But, you know, people did learn songs a lot more and know songs by heart and sing to entertain each other and to entertain themselves. So that didn't bother me, and I knew about the music hall background and so on, and it would just be a song that they knew the same way we could probably sing all the verses of American Pie. I just didn't think,
I'm obviously wrong, but reading it, I thought, that doesn't sound like it would fit to a Hawaiian.
Well, it is a Hawaiian song.
I was disappointed Steph didn't actually sing it.
Well, yes.
I can't sing. No, I did a lot of research into this because the Hawaiian girl on his shoulder, I looked at tattoos, and actually a lot of sailors had a lot of tattoos.
And I've seen that done where the Hawaiian, they do the little dance.
The Hawaiian girl, sailors often had tattoos, and I've brought with me, in case anybody challenged me on the tattoos. The tattoos first started in the Polynesian islands anyway. Yes, that's where they kind of originate from. Yeah. And tattoo is actually a Hawaiian word.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tattoo from the Tahitian tartau.
Mm-hmm.
And sailors set a trend in the Royal Navy, and by the early 19th century, most British sailors had a tattoo.
You weren't a proper sailor without a tattoo.
No, and of course Albert had served in World War One.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so he would have got a tattoo then, and the Hawaiian girl was quite a thing, and Aloha He was the song that they sang with Lulu dancing. So it does all fit, but you don't have to put all that in the compost.
Those detail orientated queries apart, I absolutely loved it, and I love the bit at the end where she says about the wrong version of herself.
That
was absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, I think it is too.
What caused me to pause though was you gave me strength to be my own person, and it was another one of those that I just thought
a bit modern.
Mm. It sounded too modern, even if it is authentic.
As we're talking about that piece, that for me was the only slight false note.
Mm.
And I thought, damn you, Albert, she willed her thoughts to reach him. You gave me the strength to be my own person, then you betrayed me. It's a bit melodramatic. Mm-hmm. And even if it was, oh, Albert, you know, it's different. I don't know if it's the damn you, but just that bit for me was a little bit melodramatic in contrast to the subtlety of the rest of the piece.
Mm.
But really, that's all I could think, you know, that's the only false note in that for me.
I didn't see it that way. I thought the damn you, Albert, was heartfelt. She is so frustrated and so...
Because she's remembering how wonderful it was.
And she's been...
Something he did.
She's been very upset with him.
Yeah.
Mm.
So the fact that she's been so upset with him, I'm not at all surprised to hear it's a damn you, Albert.
Yeah, well, it's different readers feel different. Right. And that's fine, as I say. And I was trying very hard to find something to criticise.
Do we know what Albert's done to betray her at this point? Or is it...
No, we don't. No. Okay. You won't know that at all.
So this is showing us that he's done something serious.
I think we knew that because she fantasises about him dying. Remember
in the very early piece.
You've made reference, haven't you, before about he's done something.
Well, Stephanie, it just makes me want to push you into writing the rest of it so that we can read the whole thing.
It's all written. I've just got to edit it.
Yes.
Well, there we go, as we heard.
Thank you very much.
I've got the look from it.
Thank you. Okay, Nicola, are you going to share the quirks of writing?
I am indeed, yes. I can't even remember how I stumbled across this, but I remember thinking this would be quite fun because I know how fond some of you are of your stationery, particularly. Edgar Allan Poe loved scrolling so much. Now, scrolling is where you add lots of bits of paper and you write as fast as you possibly can, because some writers feel that just pausing to put another sheet of paper in the typewriter or whatever is breaking their flow. So he attached several pieces of paper together with sealing wax and formed it in one long scroll. Jack Kerouac took it a bit further. He was particularly partial to scrolling. In 1951, he'd been planning his book for years and he'd amassed sufficient notes in his journals. And then he wrote On the Road in one long feverish burst, pouring his soul onto paper in one long strip. So after completing the manuscript, he went into his editor's office and proudly span out the scroll across the floor. But his publisher rejected it, saying nobody could make corrections on such a manuscript. James Joyce wrote on his stomach and bed with quite a big blue pencil, wearing a white coat.
He's a very strange character.
In his case, it was more practicality than superstition, because he had actually a very bad eyesight and the large crayons helped him to be able to read what he was writing himself.
You should try that, Nicola.
Yes, large crayons. Truman Capote, he was far more superstitious. He wouldn't begin or end a piece of work on a Friday. He would change hotel rooms if the room phone number involved the number 13, and he never left more than 3 cigarette butts in his ashtray, tucking the extra ones into his coat pocket. This is almost the best, though. In the fall of 1830, Hugo set out to write The Hunchback of Notre Dame against the impossible deadline of February 1831, so that was fall of 1 year to spring of next year. He purchased an entire bottle of ink and put himself under house arrest by locking away his clothes and just keeping a grey shawl for himself. So he couldn't leave the house.
Right, that's what I need to do.
There you go.
But listen, he finished the book weeks before deadline, using up a whole bottle of ink to write it.
So it does work. It works. Yeah.
And then there were various people who could only write on a particular shade of blue paper. One person would only write on his poetry on yellow and his articles on pink. And other people, when travelling on Europe, they ran out of their adored blue paper and were forced to write on a cream-coloured pad. Charles Dickens was partial to blue ink. It dried faster than other colours, so it allowed him to write faster. And Virginia Woolf used different coloured inks in her different pens. Purple was her favourite.
Didn't Barbara Cartland have one of those?
I didn't think she picked up a pen. Yeah. She lay on the sofa and secretary wrote in shorthand and then typed it up.
Right. No, that was Little Britain. All these eccentricities. Does it show a lack of confidence or something that you actually believe there's luck involved?
I think it's like Joe Nesbo. I read an article about Joe Nesbo and he had a wonderful study built in his house, you know, with pinboards and whiteboards and lighting and, you know, bookshelves and, you know, everything you could. If you just dreamt of your most favourite writing space, that's what it was.
Yeah.
And then he went back to the cafe that he'd always been writing in and stood and waited till his favourite table in the corner was vacant and then went and sat and wrote there and never used his special study. So I think for some people, getting into the zone is having those rituals around them.
I mean, I've got to say, I absolutely hate writing with biros. I've got 2 biros on the go at the moment. I hate them.
What are biros?
Just normal pens.
Ballpoint pens.
I like to write with
biros.
That's a trade name in England.
Invented by, I can't remember his
French
first name.
No, Biro.
I thought he was Hungarian. Belgium. But anyway, the biro is the name of the inventor of the ballpoint pen.
Anyway, they're too slow.
UK we call them biros rather than ballpoint pens.
Yeah.
Okay.
So for me, they're too slow. It feels hard work writing with them, whereas with a rollerball, it feels effortless. Right. And the other thing is I can't bear to write in black ink. I only want to write in blue ink.
Right.
And I obviously like my moleskin, so I am turning into one of these writers who's got stationary quirks.
I like my fountain pen for handwriting.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Writing letters and that kind of thing.
But then it takes a long time to choose which fountain pen you want to use. Because, you know, basically, how many do I have now? 6 or 8. And I have to take the fountain pen out and first of all see if it's writing, because sometimes they dry up from it. But I have to write a little bit with each one to see which one feels the best.
Then you have to get your pen knife out and mend the nib.
Procrastination.
I can't write with a fountain pen.
Really?
Yeah. I blame you. We were taught to write italic.
I was. And it's no good for handwriting. That's why I've got such bad handwriting.
Yeah, my handwriting's atrocious.
Because you can't write.
It doesn't translate, does it? Mm. It doesn't transfer.
So now we're going to talk about poetry. Maybe our favourite poets, favourite poems. And I'll go straight to Linda to see if she has one.
Well, yes, what I have here is an introduction to poetry written by Billy Collins, who was formerly the poet laureate of the United States. I love his poetry. I have many books. This one in particular is suitable, I think, today. Introduction to Poetry. I asked them to take a poem and hold it up to the light like a color slide, or press an ear against its hive. I say, drop a mouse into a poem and watch him probe his way out, or walk inside the poem's room and feel the wall for light switch. I want them to water ski across the surface of the poem, waving at the author's name on the shore. But all they want to do is tie the poem to a chair with rope and torture a confession out of it. They begin beating it with a hose to find out what it really means.
I love that. I like that.
Yeah. Anybody that's taught will relate to that.
Well, that's it with poetry, isn't it? What does it mean?
Yeah.
Tell me the answer.
I don't know. I wasn't particularly, but... Yeah, but it is that anxiety that people have that I'm not going to understand this. So that's my task now, is to find out what this means and pin it down, and rather than just experience it.
Perhaps
enjoy
that's
it.
Why I like very obvious poetry that's, you know, da 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 poems that are not free verse and abstract and actually tell stories. Mm-hmm. So, but then I was raised on Robert Louis Stevenson's Child's Garden of Verses.
Lovely,
and,
yeah.
And I still recite those poems frequently.
I remember as an undergraduate when we were studying poetry, and I never read a lot of poetry and I still don't read an awful lot, but I felt very frustrated with poets who were writing all of this, you know, this beautiful words and things. And I would think, why don't you just come out and say what you want to say? You know, why do we have to go over this roundabout method? What do you want?
Well, that sounds like Mary Magdalene talking.
Yeah, it really does.
Say what you mean to say.
Yeah.
But now I have, and my favorite poets now are poets who are very accessible, like Billy Collins certainly is. Pablo Neruda. I like his poetry a lot.
Yeah, I don't like reading poetry particularly because I think poetry should be the spoken word.
Yeah.
I find reading it sometimes quite tedious, and it's looking for what it's actually saying, whereas listening to it, I can get a lot more feeling from
that
it.
That sort of performance poetry.
Yes, John Cooper Clarke is one of my favourites. Yeah. Billy Bragg, you know, sort of people. Yeah.
I remember the Raving Beauties as well from the 80s and 90s. I love their stuff, and maybe some of that was more abstract.
Yeah, and song,
because it was performed.
And song lyrics. Yeah,
oh,
it was poetry.
Song lyrics. Oh, yeah. Rappers and hip-hop artists are creating poetry now.
Well, that poem or song that I read in my piece, I mean, that's actually a song, but it's a beautiful, beautiful poem as well, isn't it?
Well, controversially, Dylan's lyrics... Got it. The Nobel Prize for Literature.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
But interestingly, I think you said your favourite is still Charles Gardner verse. And you just think about children's acquisition of language, and so much of it is done through rhyme and verse and
rhythms
and so on, isn't it?
Mm.
And it's probably the first language, formalised language, they encounter.
I was taught choric speech at school.
Yes.
What is that?
It's performing poetry. So you'd say...
In groups.
We are going to see the rabbit. And then everybody would join in and say, we are going to see the rabbit. The only rabbit. The only rabbit in England. Sitting behind a barbed wire fence.
Good grief.
I must get out of this.
And McCavity's the mystery cat. He's called the Hidden Claw because he's the master criminal who can defy the law.
I remember this. Brilliant.
And we would do this choric speech. It's like a choir of spoken word.
Oh. And did you do a movement?
Of course, we did the original meaning of the word, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, yeah. It is.
Yeah.
But it's lovely.
Obviously went to a posh school than I did.
Yes, I have to say, Dorrington High School didn't cover poetry very well.
No, I don't think we did.
I mean,
kids actually like
learning poems and reciting poems.
Of course they do. That's
poems.
Why you sing nursery rhymes and things to children, because it's the wordplay, it's the magic of the sounds that appeals.
Yeah. Even the very first things that we start to learn, like the alphabet, are learned and sung. A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Right, and it's a lot of fun for kids
until
to do that.
Until you get to Zed.
Don't start. I'm biting my tongue.
Until you get to Z. Z. What the heck? Where do you get an E-D?
There are worse things. I'm getting off the point now, but what about, the redundant Scottish letter Zog? which looks like a Z, but it's in like minis and things like that. It looks like a Z, but it's pronounced differently.
It's in
I've got no idea. What
Minis is a Scottish, like the paper shop John Minis Menzies.
Oh, Menzies.
Minis.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, it's the redundant Scottish letter Zog.
Okay.
I'm not someone who loves poetry at all, and I really can't, a bit like you, why don't they just say it in the story? But as I was researching it, I remembered that I really enjoyed some of the poems that were in from the first World War poets that were in a book I particularly love, The Rainbow Comes and Goes. And then I went looking for, again, if I could find anything. And I found a poem by D.H. Lawrence. And I know I've got some dim knowledge that you've said that a poem is written in a certain structure.
There are lots of different
structures. And I thought, this is interesting because I've just found a poem by D.H. Lawrence. And I thought, I quite like the way that the punctuation seems to come in the middle of the row, which is a bit weird. So it's a bit like telling a story, but that something about the structure of the poetry means that the story has to be told in a slightly different way. And then you've got this rhythm thing coming in. So I really started to quite enjoy some of the poems I came across. And I thought, actually, I don't hate poetry at all. I just, it's not an easy, accessible way of hearing a story for me.
Can you read a little of what you're talking about there, D.H. Lawrence?
Well, it's just, it's a good example of this punctuation coming in the middle of the row, really. Softly in the dusk, a woman is singing to me. Take me back down the vista of years till I see a child sitting under the piano in the boom of the tingling strings and pressing the small poised feet of a mother who smiles as she sings. In spite of myself, the insidious mastery of song betrays me back till the heart of me weeps to belong to the old Sunday evenings at home with winter outside and hymns in the cosy parlour, the tinkling piano our guide. So now it is vain for the singer to burst into clamour with the great black piano appassionato. The glamour of childish days is upon me. My manhood is cast down in the flood of remembrance. I weep like a child for the past. So it doesn't actually sound like a poem at all. It's not doing that umpty-dumpty-dumpty.
No. Right. It's not doing
casting a spell.
I think I prefer Lawrence's poetry to his novels.
Definitely.
There's one, Bavarian Gentians, which I like very much, but I haven't got it to hand, so I can't read it to you. Yeah. But
I like Philip Larkin's This Be the Verse. I like to quote that. I won't quote it now because it's got the F word in it. But
You could just say
is it the one about your mum and dad?
They famous you line. Up your mum and dad. They may not mean to, but they do. They fill you with the faults they had and add some extra just for you. But they were in their turn. By fools in old style hats and coats, who half the time were soppy stern and half at one another's throats. Man hangs on misery to man, it deepens like a coastal shelf. Get out as early as you can and don't have any kids yourself. That's got a really powerful sort of message.
Yeah,
it
does.
It's dumpty 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 dumpty,
isn't it? You can tell it's a poem because there's words that rhyme with each other at the ends of each line.
But they don't have to.
They don't have to. Yeah. And then you've got the onigin, which is something like AABB. CD, and it changes all the time. Right. And there's whole novels written in onigin verse.
Yeah.
Whole novels.
And when I first, when you're reading poetry in the beginning, you kind of go and you stop at the end of the line. But then you learn that you stop where the punctuation is. Yeah. So you read to the punctuation, which made it a lot clearer.
That's what I found. Definitely. Yeah.
But we haven't really talked about how we use poetry and how it fits into people's lives, because one of the things that, you know, we find is where do we encounter poetry in life? Well, weddings and funerals very often. And it is almost like at these really significant life-changing moments, we need something which is a higher form of expression, if that's, you know, perhaps not quite the right way to put it, but it's almost like we need this different tone to our expression. And so we choose poetry for those times of heightened emotion, should we say.
And I find I write poetry at times of heightened emotion, when I'm feeling things very keenly. Writing a poem about them is... It just comes. It doesn't need a lot of effort. But I wouldn't call myself a poet. To actually sit down and work on a poem seems like something that would never happen to me.
I think it's the most difficult literary form, and I don't think I have the ability to use words in such an intense way. Really, I don't think it's
like a challenge to me.
Not for me. I feel I have written poems in my life,
but they're things that kind of come with emotion, and the, you know, kind of the muse hits you and takes you, and you write something. And but I could never sit down. Right, today I'm going to write a poem.
I mean, I can do that, as we know, with a Tuesday to sit down and write. But I think the same thing. Poetry is something that springs into your head, or for me. And leaving my grandchildren again prompted me to, you know, just write to do sort of them, just write them. Because I was going to be, you know, so not seeing them for a little while.
Well, here's something I've never told any of you. I once won a prize for a poem I wrote as an undergraduate. I got $25 for it.
That was a lot of money in those days.
I once
won a gold star.
Oh, well done.
And a certificate at school. I got a poetry competition at school. Yeah. It was about King Arthur. King Arthur was a hearty soul who fought near night and day, and anyone who was but foul King Arthur did but slay. I think it was a ballad. Anyway, the Ballad of King Arthur. It went on for several verses. I won't bore you with all of it.
Yeah, I won a poetry competition when I was 17, but it was a pretentious piece of...
How much did you make?
I can't remember. It was probably £10 or something. But, you know, anyway.
Well, this makes me think of right at the beginning of Write Club, because my previous experience of a writing group was a therapeutic writing group where you'd share your work and somebody would say, you know, well done, Heather, thank you for sharing. And the first time I shared a poem with this group, it was just... a slap in the face and a kick up the bum.
Kindly done, I'm sure.
Well, it was
a shock, I'm sure, because what we have vowed to each other is that we will help each other become the very best writers that we can be, and in doing so, we do kick each other's shins now and then, but it's only done with love.
Absolutely.
And I'd like to say at this point, I hadn't joined Write Club.
I wasn't present. It was
We're sitting with our halos on over.
It just wasn't very good.
You said it started off beautifully, whimsically.
I'll remember now. When asked to think of a favourite poem or poet, I really couldn't do that because I like so much poetry, right from, you know, medieval poetry up to the modern day. And I found that very difficult. But then I remembered the first poem that made an impression on me at the age of 8 years old. And the reason for this was I'm one of five children, and whenever we met people, they would always say to my sisters, "Oh, aren't you lovely?" or to my brothers, aren't you a handsome boy? And they'd look at me and say, "What a lot of freckles you've got. Aren't you small?" So I had this idea that I was like the ugly duckling in a very attractive family.
So sad.
No, it's poignant, isn't it? But when I had a lovely teacher when I was 8 years old, and I wish I knew her name, but I don't. But she was very fond of poetry, and she taught us to sing Men of Harlech in Welsh. She was Welsh. This was at a British Army school in Germany. And this poem gave me a bit of a boost, and many of you will know it. I'm not sure about the sprung rhythm, is difficult to read, but I'll do my best. It's Pied Beauty by Gerard Manley Hopkins. Glory be to God for dappled things, for skies of couple colour as a brinded cow, for rose moles all in stipple upon trout that swim, fresh fire coal, chestnut falls, finches' wings, landscape plotted and pieced, fold, fallow and plough, and all trades their gear and tackle and trim. All things counter, original, spare, strange, whatever is fickle, freckled, who knows how. With swift, slow, sweet, sour, a dazzle dim, he fathers forth whose beauty is past change. Praise him. And I like that, not for its religious sentiment, but because it celebrates difference.
Right. Mm.
Yeah. And freckles.
And freckles.
Dappled things.
A bit emotional there as well.
No, not at all.
Okay, Pat, you've got one you'd like to share?
I can't remember all of it. One of my favourites, I mean, like Teresa, I do like a range of poetry, though it's not something I read very often, but I think one of my all-time favourites is Jenny Joseph's When I Am an Old Woman, I Shall Wear Purple, with a red hat
that doesn't go.
Yeah. I'm getting there.
Yeah. And that's a poem, particularly when, you know, I've been teaching adults who, and we're doing poetry, and they go, poetry, you know, and they're scared stiff. And then you get
it's
give
a
them
very
that poem,
accessible
and they,
poem.
They respond to it. Yeah, exactly. They can identify and the feeling, and it is very accessible.
Someone just popped into my head. In Xanadu did Kublai Khan his wonders to behold.
A sacred pleasure dome decree.
Oh, yes. Is it? Okay.
Yes, it's Coleridge, isn't it?
Is it?
Yeah.
That just popped into my head when we were talking about it.
It's all deep down there.
Yeah.
The one I recite to my grandchildren when they don't want to go to bed is one that I remember from being a very little girl, and it's called Bed in Summer by Robert Louis Stevenson. And I've got it printed here, but I don't need to read it, you know. It's in winter I get up at night and dress by yellow candlelight. In summer, quite the other way, I have to go to bed by day. I have to go to bed and see the birds still hopping on the tree and hear the grown-up people's feet still going past me in the street. And does it not seem hard to you when all the sky is clear and blue and I would so much like to play to have to go to bed by day?
That just sums it up, doesn't it?
That's really a Scottish childhood, isn't it? With the contrast in the day hours.
That's wonderful. Yeah. Wonderful.
Okay. Thank you very much. And now we have the interview with poet Neil Fawcett.
Okay, so today we're talking to Neil Fawcett about writing poetry. Neil, talking about you, when did you start writing poetry?
I started writing poetry many years ago, probably soon after I left school. I discovered the poetry of Percy Bysshe Shelley, because I've always been a political animal. And his approach to solving the problems of the world appealed to me as a 16-year-old kid. So yes, it was very early on. We had the riots in Britain, you know, in 81 and all that kind of stuff. And I thought, you know, this sort of spoke to me, my political perspective that had been inculcated into me by my rabid socialist father. He's still around, the old fella, and he's still spouting his red rhetoric. But yeah, that's what started me off many years ago. Yeah, I didn't write a lot for quite a while until I met Jules, my wife, and I got myself mixed up in this terrible commitment, which involved having to write her a poetry for every major occasion that occurred in our lives. So it's like 4 poems a year, with its poetry from Valentine's Day, Christmas, birthday, anniversary. So we've married for 28 years now. So we're out 28 times 4. That's how many poems she's had from me. So that sort of kicked it in for me again 30 years ago. And I've been writing since then, quite seriously. Yeah.
So did you do English at school? You know, did you love English at school? Did you want to be a writer when you were at school?
I went to a really bad school. I was a part of the generation. It was the last year of the 11 plus. I triumphantly failed my 11 plus. So I went to what was a secondary modern school in South Manchester. And although it was all supposed to be comprehensive and we were all supposed to be on equal footing with the grammar schools, it didn't quite work out like that. So there's a hangover. We still had the teachers that had been there from before who, you know, probably weren't as committed. Well, maybe they were committed, but the character of the school probably wasn't as good as it could have been. So I struggled at school a little bit in terms of finding an outlet for the things I wanted to do. But my favourite teacher was the English teacher, and he introduced me to a number of things which sparked my interest later in life. Yeah. So, it's really difficult talking about yourself, isn't it? I've never done this before. carry on. Go on.
Apart from Shelley, do you have any other favourite poets?
Oh, no, he's the only one, Pat. Now, from Shelley, I sort of graduated to a guy called Adrian Mitchell many years later. At school, obviously, with GCSE, I loved Philip Larkin, Whitsun Weddings, and the rest. His sort of lyrical pessimism sort of chimed with my approach to life. But Adrian Mitchell, I was given a poetry collection of his when I was 17, 18, called For Beauty Douglas. And that had a great impact on me. I really loved the stuff that he wrote. It was comical, serious, abstract, and that's probably reflects my character a little bit. So I really enjoyed his work. But from then, obviously, yeah, I mean, I've really got into poetry, and I've read lots of different poets, and in recent times, I've been enamoured with the Greek poets, so Kafafi, Seferis, Yanis Ritsos. And as you know, Pat, I spent the best part of 2.5 years out there indulging my interest in Greece and Greek poetry. And I wrote a lot of stuff while I was spending half the year out there.
So apart from Greece and apart from 4 occasions a year for Jules, what else inspires you to write?
What inspires me to write? Place, people, politics, philosophy. You know, the whole gamut of things. When I describe myself as a plain dealer of words, if you like, and I like to use vernacular. I'm interested in. I inhabit a language which is well worn, if you like. It's not over verbose or flowery, and I write about things that happen around me and to me. Why poetry?
In other styles or other forms very often?
Yeah, well, I do. When I first started writing poetry, and sometimes I will sort of digress into writing poetic form like Sestinas or Villanelles or sonnets, and I enjoy doing that because it's a challenge to work within a framework. You know, to discipline yourself to work within that particular framework, but that's not my choice of poetry. Why poetry? Because it speaks to me. Because it's immediate. It can be chaotic. It can be abstract, and it allows me to describe the things that eat away at me inside, to crystallize thoughts, passions, emotions. On a gloomy day, poetry could be like a lightning in a dull cloud, you know, that's the way it works for me. I think it's a particular part of my psyche. That's the way. I've tried writing prose. I've tried writing novels. In fact, I've just given up on my third novel. I gave up on the first two as well. But, but poetry is more immediate and it works for me.
Did you have any training of any kind, Neil, or did you just start writing? Did you have any mentors or training?
I did just start writing, but I mean, since then I've had mentors. I did the MA in poetry at the Manchester Writing School, which was headed up by Caroline Duffy. So she's mentored me. We've had a few beers here because she used to take her classes out of the classroom because she thought it was a sterile environment. She said, "Well, let's just get down the pub. We go down the pub." And we'd write poetry and we'd talk poetry. So yes, but that's in later years when I could afford to do an MA with Caroline Duffy. But before that, I was out on my own. And initially, my work was probably quite florid, but I've toned that down and become a little more austere with my words, I think. Am I rambling on too much?
No, not at all. The only reason we're quiet is because we're listening to what you're saying and it's fascinating. We're genuinely interested.
It is. When you say poetry speaks to you, but for a lot of people, they find it quite intimidating? Not your poetry specifically, but poetry in general. Why do you think that is?
It takes work, doesn't it, to get into a poem. Very often you can't get it first time. You've got to read it and then read it again and think, ooh, yeah. Occasionally, the spark sparks will ignite in your head, and they do. Mm. But that's it. Something that it's because you're relating to a direct experience, which you get right away. Whether the poet intended you to get that, you get it from the poem, which is the important thing. But sometimes you do need to work at it. You need to sit down and consider exactly what the poet's getting at. Mm. So it's not easily accessible, immediately accessible. I think performance poetry is obviously easily accessible because you can see the person performing and you can work from their expressions and their gestures and you can get it a lot more easily. But poetry for the page is probably, it takes a little bit more work, I think. Yeah.
I was just thinking before you said that about performance poetry that you have to get into the rhythm, don't you? And sometimes you can only do that, like you say, on the second or third read through.
Yeah.
You get the rhythm of it, and then the way it appears on the page starts to make sense.
Mm. Yeah, it can do, yeah. But of course, the different genres, aren't they? So a lot of poetry, performance poetry, doesn't work on the page. It's not interesting.
Mm.
What's interesting about performance poetry is the way it's performed very often. And you can get away with a lot of stylistic anomalies by performing it because you're the personality in front of the audience, and you can get by that. But if you're writing poetry with the page, it's a lot more difficult to you're a lot more exposed, I think.
Yeah. And perhaps you have to be more formal when you're writing, when knowing that someone isn't going to be there to hear you saying it, so that they can't miss. Understand what you're trying to say. Perhaps the structure gives the the formality that I'm just completely guessing here, and I might edit all this out, but I'm quite new to poetry, but I've been I really did enjoy yours, and when we did our episode we all had to go off and find poems we liked, didn't we? So it's definitely kindled an interest.
Do you do performance poetry, Neil?
Yes, I do. I've done quite a lot of that, and it's fun. Yeah.
You enjoy it?
Yeah. I've done quite a lot of performance around venues in Manchester. But it's completely different. It's utterly different. I wouldn't write down the poems that I perform, but rarely.
Right.
Mm. Do you mean that you're actually ad-libbing when you're performing poetry?
No. You're not ad-libbing, but you can skip over problematic areas. If you're working on a poem, you're editing a poem, it takes time and exactitude. You've got to pore over every word, every syllable, every adjective. That's what you've got to do. But if you're performing a poem, you can rely more upon your performance, your skill as a performer, I suppose. And people aren't hanging on every syllable or every adjective. They're watching you and how you do it. It's like singing a song, I suppose.
Yeah. So how much, you said about when you're writing poetry, you're sort of agonising over every adjective, word, line and so on. So would you say that your poems are really sort of thoroughly crafted, or do they come to you and almost as they appear on the page?
I'd say that some of them are thoroughly crafted for me. Mm. And some people that craft their work a lot more rigorously than I do, but some do come to me, and it's usually by reading other poetry. I can be sitting there with a glass of wine, reading a book of poetry, and I may have not written something for a while, but then it just something flares, and I think, yeah, I'm going to write that down. Wow, that's really good. I'm going to stick it on Facebook. And then I wake up the following morning and I think, oh, Jesus Christ, why did I put that on Facebook?
A glass of wine would have had something to do with it.
maybe. But yeah, some of them I'll pour over for a long, long time. I'll really work hard on them. Some of them I think I can't really do much with, and they come out more or less complete.
Yeah. Advice for would-be poets? Do you have any?
Yeah. I well, don't use abstract nouns.
Oh, really?
Okay.
I'm sitting here thinking, what is an abstract noun?
Forget peace, forget love, forget anger, forget passion. Don't use those words.
Okay.
Think of something else to describe what those words mean to you.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've got a question.
Sure.
How do you become a published poet? How did it happen to you? How did it come about?
Well, I entered a couple of competitions a good few years ago, sent a couple of poems off, and I was quite lucky, actually, that the first poetry competition I entered, like Poetry Pulse, I think it was, the organisation, I bloody won it. And it was a 300 quid prize. I'm like, yes, I'm really good at this. But,
oh, excellent.
But then it tailed off a little bit. You know. But it's a matter of persevering. You know, I was talking to somebody, I was on a poetry course the other day at Manchester Art Gallery, and I was talking to the guy who runs it, and he said, you know, you send 100 poems off, you get one published. So you just got to keep sending stuff off and off and off, because at the end of the day, I mean, it's subjective. People might not like the stuff that you do or the stuff that you write, but occasionally it will spark with somebody and they'll say, oh yeah, we'll stick that in. I mean, so it's hit and miss. Mm. And there's no money in it. Mrs. Money, Jim, there's no money in it. So.
Oh, no. Okay, so this might seem like a really abstract question, but do you remember all your poems or do you have them filed in a particular way? And if so, do you have them cross-referenced by type of poem, subject matter, title?
Nicola, I've got probably the most chaotic mind that exists on the whole of this earth, and I have to scroll through hundreds and hundreds and hundreds to think, you know, maybe I'll work on this one this day. I need an editor. I need somebody to take all my stuff and put it together. So, no, there's no cross-referencing. There's scrolling through years of, and some good stuff. They're scrolling through it all and then and finding something, a little nugget of something that you can work with. I do need to be more organised. Thanks for that.
Well, no, I mean, I was just thinking how I would cope, and I'm not very organised at all. So not at all. So that's why I was asking the question. Yeah, no, that's who you need.
Yeah.
I do. It's true. Yeah.
She's our organiser.
Is being a published poet someone who gets things published ad hoc occasionally, or have you had books? You know, have you been approached to put a book together or anything like that yet?
I haven't been approached. No, I've been anthologised. Mm. I've been asked if I want to be part of an anthology. I've done that a couple of times, but it's down to me to collate the work that I've done into a coherent group of poems, which will work as a collection. I have them, especially in recent years, at the time I spent around Stupa. So from the Stupa time, I've got about 60, 70 poems which I could collate into a collection. I could do it. I mean, I just haven't organised myself to do it. But
and if, you know, from there, if you did that, would you then approach, are there publishers in the UK who specialise in that kind of anthology?
Yes. Lots, yeah. Okay. Yeah, there are. With varying, you know, varying degrees of status. So I mean, it depends. I mean, you can self-publish if you want, but I don't want to do that because I do need some external verification for, you know, for myself in terms of what I'm doing is reaching people. So I know many people who do poetry gigs in Manchester, and they'll sell their chapbook or their poetry collection at the end of the gig, but they publish it themselves. They spent a few hundred quid publishing a few copies, but that doesn't work for me. If I was to send a collection off, I'd want favour and favour. T.S. Eliot's old publishing house to say, yes, you're absolutely brilliant, Fawcett. We're going to publish you. That's what I want. It's not happened yet, but we'll see.
I'm the lone voice in favour of self-publishing in the Right Club. Everybody else wants a proper deal.
No, but I think it's different, isn't it? It's different for different genres. I mean, I'm obviously not read your book yet, but it's a thing which will really interest people who want to do the best with the money, presumably.
Yeah, that was my first one. I'm onto a sci-fi novel now, and I've only done.
Oh, right.
I've only done 4,000 words, so it's a long way off yet.
But having said that, I mean, Auden, W.H. Auden, self-published in the 30s, one of the greatest poets that's ever been in the English language. He self-published. He couldn't get published. He self-published.
I mean, it's hard for like first-time novelists to get published. I would imagine it's even harder for poets.
Yeah, because not that many people are interested in poetry. But having said that, there are a lot of people who write first-time novels, aren't there?
Less competition in poetry, perhaps. Great. Well, thank you very much. It's been really interesting, and I've learned a lot more about poetry from listening to you. I just love the fact that you come, you know, you love the same place that we do, and I really enjoyed your paintings as well when I looked at your website.
Nicola, I adore the place that you are sitting in now. I am green with envy. You walking out that door at the back there, where are you walking into? Describe it to me. Poetically.
oh, God, that's too terrifying for words. It's a shimmering ocean of green. Sunlight.
Get you there.
Oh, dear. God, I feel ill now. Just come over all hot and sweaty. I look forward to meeting you in person when you come out next time.
I'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Lovely.
You will indeed. Okay, Neil, thanks.
Give my love to Mike.
Thank you, Neil. Bye.
Bye.
We're almost at the end, but first of all, we're going to ask Teresa to tell us what's on her bedside table.
Okay, on my bedside table is a thriller by Peter May, and it's called The Black House, and it's the first in a trilogy. The others are The Lewis Man and The Chessmen. As a brutal killing takes place on the Isle of Lewis, Scotland, a land of harsh beauty and inhabitants of deep-rooted faith. A murder. Detective Inspector Finn MacLeod is sent from Edinburgh to investigate. For Lewis-born MacLeod, the case represents a journey both home and into his past. A secret, something lurks within the close-knit island community, something sinister. A trap, as Finn investigates, old skeletons begin to surface, and soon he, the hunter, becomes the hunted. And the reason this stands above the average in the genre for me is it's very well written and it has a really strong sense of place. He describes the landscape and the culture and the lives, how lives are lived on the Isle of Lewis, and some of their traditions, they go to another island. It's a sort of rite of passage for young men. They go to this very austere place where they hunt a particular seabird and so on. So those details make it above average, and I'd strongly recommend that.
Lovely.
Mm. I love Peter May. Yeah. I've read quite a few of his. Coffin Road was excellent as well.
Yeah, I'd like to read more.
And Ursula Banting, what's on your bedside table?
The book is called Into the Darkest Corner by Elizabeth Haynes. The book features two central characters. One is a young lady called Catherine, who has been single for quite some time. She meets a guy by the name of Lee, who she thinks is the man of her dreams. She can't believe her luck that she's met somebody that is so wonderful. Her friends initially are along the lines of, if it's too good to be true, then it is. But what actually transpires through the story, and I am only halfway through, is that he is a psychological abuser. He's coercive in his control. He has severe OCD, and he is starting to isolate Catherine in every aspect of her life. Interestingly enough, as the story is unfolding, as much as her friends are initially said that he was too good to be true, they are now falling under his spell and actually adore him, which is resulting in Catherine, I guess, turning into herself and not sharing what's going on. And when she does talk to her friends, they're not listening to her and not believing her, which is putting her in a situation whereby she's trapped. I think that the characters are incredibly believable. When you hear the story, which is being told from Catherine's viewpoint, you can very much almost live under her skin. But I also have a lot of question marks as to what has made the boyfriend act in this way and feel that this is acceptable within a relationship. It is incredibly interesting to me, this whole kind of coercive, compulsive behaviour, and also that psychological kind of abuse that no one actually gets to see any of the scars because they're all mental. And the reason that I've chosen this book is that I do enjoy psychological thrillers, but I'm a massive fan of The Archers. And in 2016 and early 2017, there was a major storyline within The Archers between two characters. One was called Helen Archer and the other one was Rob Titchener, which was very much along the same lines, that Helen was in a relationship that turned out not to be the fairy tale that she believed, and that Rob Titchener was systematically abusing her from a behavioural perspective and through coercive control. That's as far as I've got. So far, I'm thoroughly enjoying it. There's lots of twists and turns, lots of suspense. If it was a real book, it'd be a real page-turner, but at the moment, it's just a real swiper. OK, thanks. Bye.
So we're nearing the end. Don't forget to enter our short story competition. Next week, we'll be giving you some help. This has been Write Club the Podcast. Subscribe to iTunes or Stitcher so every new show is automatically delivered wherever you want it. Join our Facebook group. Just search for Write Club the Podcast. Leave a review and tell a friend about Write Club.
Brilliant.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Bye. Bye.